25-1760 CV, Glover versus Connecticut General Life, Lincoln National Life, Glover, Connecticut General Life, Lincoln National Life, Vita Longevity Fund. And let's see how this is divvied up. When you all get settled up here, I want to clarify who's arguing what. But first get settled. Okay, Mr. Savage, you're up first for the appellant, and I understand you would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Zach Savage for the appellants. The district court's decision to certify this class should be reversed because it fails three independent class certification requirements: typicality, class standing, and adequacy. And I'd like to start with typicality and class standing because they highlight just how far the class that the district court certified here strays from an ordinary breach of contract class. The class includes over 19,000 class members who, unlike the class representatives, do not have contracts with either of the defendants. And not only is that result foreclosed by Mazze and the class standing cases that we cite, but if it were allowed to stand, it would dramatically expand the sweep of classes permitted under Rule 23, not just for settlement classes, but for litigation classes as well.
Why would it follow for litigation classes as well?
Because under Amchem and Ortiz, the same requirements, putting aside trial manageability, that apply for a settlement class apply in the litigation context as well. And in fact, again, putting aside trial manageability, which we're not arguing here, they take on a heightened importance in the settlement context. So in fact, the requirements are even lower in the litigation context than the class context, than the settlement context.
So I'm struggling with that a little bit. I get that. I mean, I know that is what the cases say, but what's tricky for me about this case is that if you believe that there's not a significant difference in the strength of the respective claims in these various cases, and that the settlement here doesn't unfairly shortchange a particular class of cases, the notion that those 19,000 people have a claim against Lincoln, I think, is a bit of a fiction. We've got the settlement that releases the actual defendants in their cases, and I don't see any allegations in the Third Amendment complaint that purport to establish a relationship. But it's a fiction that's designed to bring about a settlement that essentially treats them fairly. The concerns about not having an incentive to advance their separate claims kind of drops out when there's a settlement there. Why isn't that true?
Well, I don't think it drops out. And the reason that the requirements apply with heightened force, or at least the same force in the settlement context as in the litigation context, is because the way that the claims would be proven fundamentally affects how settlement negotiations occur. And so in the settlement negotiations, if the class representative does not have the ability to press the claims in litigation, then of course the deal that that class representative would be able to procure would be worse than otherwise. And so that's why the requirements apply with the same force. And the one other point I'll make on this is that, you know, Mazze, which is a typicality case, shows exactly how this can play out in practice. And so in Mazze, we had the same mismatch between the named plaintiff's claims and the class representative's claims. And what happened at trial is that the class representative was unable to prove the claims for those class members who could not or who were not in privity with the defendant. And fortunately, in that case, the district court was still able to decertify the class after that occurred and preserve those class members' ability to proceed in litigation. But here, in the settlement context, there's no further opportunity to adjust the class or to fix it for these class members.
Well, it would be, right? If the settlement fell apart, you could decertify the class.
Well, if the, right, and of course, that's what we're asking for here, is for the settlement to be vacated so that, in particular, all of the class members that we represent, but the New York ones in particular, who were close to trial, who had a $66 million damages model, and who had their claims extinguished for 3 cents in the dollar, go forward and proceed with that litigation.
Yeah, the 3 cents on a dollar thing is a weird, I'm sorry, I don't mean to.
No, go ahead.
Version, but it's you're representing plaintiffs. You generate as robust a theory of damages as you can, and you're settling a case. You make compromises based on the realistic considerations that both sides need to take into account. And so saying 3 cents on the dollar, like if you undisputably were entitled to the dollar, then 3 cents on a dollar would seem like a pretty bad deal. But that the whole point of a settlement is that there's a debate about that.
Sure, of course, but the point is, and this is the literary works point, is that the compromise is that those class members would have made in settlement negotiations had they been represented in settlement negotiations by their court-appointed counsel would not have been for that 3 cents on the dollar. Sure, it might not have been for 100 cents on the dollar, but it would not have been for that. And that is why literary works requires, at a bare minimum, that if you have a class that is certified already and proceeding to trial, and another class comes along that to wipe that class out, that at a minimum, that separately certified class with court-appointed counsel needs to receive independent negotiations in the settlement negotiations.
Can I just ask you to play out what I think you were discussing with Judge Robinson? I understand your argument to boil down to this notion that one set of plaintiffs here would have had to duke it out on an extra issue, which is privity, others wouldn't. And if you have a group that's got to litigate two issues to win and a group that only has to litigate one to win, the one that has to litigate two to win is more likely to compromise to a lower settlement amount, right? They have more potential points of failure, so that inherently they're more willing to compromise to account for the higher risk in litigation. Is that sort of the gist?
That's the gist, although I would...
broadly here?
That is the gist. I'll add 2 points to that. One, the privity issue was not the only issue separating those groups in terms of their leverage. There's also the fact that the New York class had survived summary judgment, had been certified, and all of those confer on them greater leverage than Glover had. And the second point is just that this is the scenario. We cite this case in our brief in the Smith versus Sprint Communications case from the Seventh Circuit, where you also had a similar situation where the court vacated the settlement under adequacy.
Would you just take a minute on the privity issue?
Yes.
And just map out why it is that that would have been a significant stumbling block, in your view, for that one group of plaintiffs, such that they would be more willing to compromise to a lower settlement. Because obviously, if there were another issue, but it was a, you know, a home run for them, you'd say, okay, fine, they have to litigate another issue, but they're sure to win. They're 99.9% sure to win, and that's not really going to lead to much of a discount that the other members of the class are going to have to suffer through.
Yeah.
So map out your argument for why this really was something that was going to lead to a discount in their minds that would not have led to a discount for other plaintiffs who didn't have to argue it.
Absolutely. I mean, the most
argue it in a different way, perhaps. I don't know.
Sure. The most basic reason is that Glover has never even articulated a theory of privity by which the New York and First Penn policyholders can establish privity with Lincoln National. The best that I understand the theory, and they haven't even quite articulated it, is that it's based on some sort of administration that Lincoln National provides to First Penn and to New York. But first of all, if you just look at the administration agreements, they explicitly say that Lincoln National is merely an independent contractor and does not assume liability on those policies. And also, the undisputed evidence refutes it because of a timing problem, which is that, again, this is undisputed, those administration agreements did not even exist for long portions of the class period. So for example, the first Penn Agreement comes into existence in 2013, but some of those first Penn policies weren't even issued until 1980. And there's no theory whatsoever as to how a class member whose policy was issued in 1980 could establish privity with Lincoln through an agreement that didn't exist for another 33 years. And just taking it back to the settlement negotiations context, of course that would have affected the leverage that Glover had to bargain for a good deal on behalf of those class members, because they had no way of establishing the first element of their breach of contract claim, which is the only claim that has been pleaded in this case.
But the privity problem is sort of an invention of this settlement package. There's not a privity problem in the sense that all of these 19,000 plaintiffs have direct claims against their actual counterparties. And those counterparties are actually released as part of the settlement. So even though they're not on the other side of the V in the case name, they're clearly part and parcel of the settlement package. If the settlement, I understand the theory about if they were litigating it, they'd have different incentives. But if you look at the settlement package and you conclude that there was no discount applied to that group based on the invented obstacle of privity, that the settlement didn't reduce their share because of that, then why? Where's the harm?
So, I mean, look, I just want to push back on the premise that it wouldn't have reduced what they're entitled to. But the harm is that these class members were deprived of the opportunity to press their claims in litigation against Lincoln National. That was a case that was close to trial and were threatening a $66 million damages model. And just putting that aside, you know, the question that the court has to answer before even getting to the adequacy question is, under typicality, does this class meet Rule 23A's typicality requirement? There's no, and class standing, which is an Article 3 issue that the court has to review de novo. And there's no case on the other side in any class settlement or litigation context that hold that when you have the first element of the class member's claims that is cannot be established for a large group of them, that certification would be appropriate. So if there are no other questions, I'll.
Okay, you've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. I understand now, next up is gonna be Ms. Perkins. Just remind me, we've got all these briefs, who are you arguing for?
Thank you, Your Honor. I am arguing on behalf of the plaintiffs.
But we also have Mr. LaSalle, who's going to be arguing, right?
On behalf of Lincoln National.
Lincoln National, got it. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Sometimes we have a lot of lawyers here, and I lose track of who's arguing for what.
May it please the court. Good morning. Lindsay Todd Perkins on behalf of the plaintiffs. Objector's appeal rests on ignoring the district court's findings and analysis, despite the standard of review here for abuse of discretion. And it relies on a distortion of the Rule 23 and class standing requirements, neither of which require every issue in the case, nor the evidence on every element of the claims to be the same or proven on the merits. I heard Mr. Savage referencing what the undisputed evidence would show. That is a summary judgment standard. That is not a Rule 23 standard. To be clear, objectors do not renew on appeal their challenges to the fairness, reasonableness, or adequacy of this $147.5 million non-reversionary cash settlement under Rule 23 or the court's Grinnell opinion. So this idea that the settlement was discounted because of some problem with the bargaining, that is not before this court on appeal. Objectors present only a class certification challenge that focuses nearly exclusively on a single issue, plaintiff Glover and a segment of the class's ability to prove the merits of their contractual privity with Lincoln, which has not been resolved against those policyholders.
So you can tell I'm sort of struggling with that, the construct here, because the Third Amendment complaint, do you agree with me that it doesn't include allegations that try to make out a claim against Lincoln? Your position is it doesn't matter if it's a meritorious claim. We can still settle it if we satisfy the other requirements for class representation. Is that an accurate understanding of your argument?
No, our position, and the Third Amendment complaint looks quite a lot like the first complaint filed in the case, including the class definition, the claims against Lincoln. The premise for the claims against Lincoln is that Lincoln assumed the contractual obligations of Connecticut General, and the evidence has shows that those same allegations would apply to the other issuing companies, First Penn.
Well, is there an allegation of that? I mean, I guess each company has its own contract with. Are we supposed to, I guess, infer from the allegations that whatever contractual arrangement Lincoln has with these with First Penn and Lanny, if I can call it that, mm-hmm. Is the same as the Connecticut General, and therefore your allegations as to privity with respect to Connecticut General carry over? Is that sort of the idea?
Well, as an initial matter, the allegations don't have to be identical for every element of the claim. Rule 23 nor class standing.
Well, my question is, are there allegations, are there any allegations that purport, I thought your position, and it may be a correct position, I don't know, but I thought your position was it doesn't matter if there's any merit to the allegation that the First Penn and the Lanny policyholders have privity with Lincoln. Cases get settled all the time where there's not merit to the charge. The defendants are entitled to buy global peace, and so we shouldn't be fussing with that question. But it seems like
I agree with you that for purposes of class certification and settlement approval, the court doesn't reach the merits. And so even if the district court or this court were to conclude that it's likely that the plaintiffs would not have been able to establish privity of contract, that is not a basis to overturn class certification or settlement approval. However, we believe we had at least colorable good faith arguments. Had the case proceeded through litigation, that we would have attempted to show that Lincoln was, in fact, the contractually liable party to all of these policyholders. But
if the plaintiffs had amended in the Third Amendment complaint, if they had amended the complaint to include First Penn and Lanny as actual defendants, do you agree with me that that would have created a standing issue, that these class representatives wouldn't have had standing to pursue those claims?
Certainly. The claim is against Lincoln for Lincoln's conduct, and plaintiffs do not allege that Lanny or First Penn harmed them. They also do not contend that Lanny or First Penn harmed any of the class members in this case.
But isn't that essentially what the settlement does, right? It would be one thing if it wasn't purporting to settle the liabilities of First Penn and Lanny, and it was just settling Lincoln's liability, but it's settling all of those, and I imagine that means that the potential exposure of First Penn and Lanny were in the mix in the settlement negotiations. That's part why there wasn't a discount for privity.
Well, certainly the defendant was seeking global peace, and the settlement agreement was explicit about the intent to release the claims pled in the related actions. But the release itself would, pursuant to the identical factual predicate doctrine, appropriately release claims arising out of the identical facts pled in the complaint and that are being released as part of the settlement, which necessarily, and the objectors do not dispute, would release the claims that were pled in the related actions by virtue of the fact that they arise out of the identical factual predicate. All claims depend on Lincoln's conduct in this case. There's really no dispute about that. The evidence that
If I'm an employer and I hire a payroll processor that messes up, or if I'm an employee, I guess, and my employer's payroll processor messes up, and it's a computer glitch that causes it to mess up for all sorts of employers all over the country, the fact that it's the payroll processor's computer glitch doesn't mean that the employee has an action against the payroll processor, the actions against the employer who may have indemnity or its own claim against the payroll processor. I mean, isn't that really the relationship between, unless and until we actually have allegations that give us privity, isn't that the relationship between Lincoln and the counterparties?
Well, the allegations were obviously made at the beginning of the case before discovery. The Third Amended complaint was meant to just carry those forward for purposes of settlement. But we would have attempted to show, and there are common law theories that would permit a non-signatory to a contract to effectively, by implication or expressly, assume those contractual obligations. Now, whether the plaintiffs would have been successful in proving that at the end of the day is not a relevant consideration for Rule 23 or class standing.
No, but what I'm trying to figure out is it feels like part of what's going on here is accomplishing something indirectly that couldn't be accomplished directly. You couldn't actually name First Penn and Lanny as defendants in a Third Amended complaint without blowing up class standing. And what I'm trying to figure out is this kind of is doing the same thing. If you couldn't do that directly, why can you do it indirectly?
Well, class standing looks at the conduct alleged to have harmed the plaintiff and whether that conduct...
Well, that's the second test. The first test is whether or not this particular plaintiff has suffered an injury at the hands of this particular defendant. You're not saying that your class representative has suffered an injury at the hands of First Penn or Lanny.
We are alleging that the plaintiffs and every class member, including those with policies issued by First Penn and Lanny, suffered injuries caused by Lincoln National.
But they wouldn't have standing to have named Lanny and First Penn on the other side of the V in the case. That's my point.
Correct.
Okay.
But the claim is against Lincoln for Lincoln's conduct that resulted in overcharges to every class member's account. So the harm that is alleged was directly caused by Lincoln National. I see I'm out of time. Are there any other questions I can answer? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. LaSalle.
Good morning, Your Honors. John LaSalle from Boies Schiller for Defendant Appellee Lincoln National. I wanted to key in on something, Judge Robinson, that you asked one of your initial questions, which is if you agree that the strength of the claims are equal across the class, does the incentive issue fall away? I believe the answer to that question is yes, but I think the fundamentally important point for this appeal is that the plaintiffs do not challenge that their claims are any stronger than the rest of the class. Judge Shea in the district court below had explicitly examined the strength of the claims and found that the objectors and the rest of the class share the same challenges, the same vulnerabilities, the same shared and likely substantial challenge that lies at the core of their claims and are in the same boat as the named plaintiffs. He found that everyone in the class is in the same boat facing the same uphill battle. And the objectors do not challenge that finding on appeal. They didn't even disclose that finding to the court in their opening brief. And instead, they don't make any challenge regarding the fairness of the settlement. Instead, they make arguments to the narrow issue as to whether these allegedly stronger claims that they simply assert, whether those allegedly stronger claims can be settled in the same class as everyone else. They have made the strength of their claims the cornerstone to this appeal, and they offer no error by the lower court, no erroneous factual finding regarding its analysis, and no effort to show that the same boat, same uphill battle findings are outside of the range of permissible decisions by the district court. Judge Nardini, you asked for a roadmap for what this would look like on the privity issue, and the court below provided that roadmap. The court acknowledged that class members may have a different difficulty of clearing the privity hurdle. But once that hurdle is cleared, they're all facing the same uphill climb for the limitations, period.
What about the fact that there would be different hills to climb? Maybe they're the same height, if you want to play the metaphor out. But I thought that the relationship between Lincoln as the administrator of these policies with respect to each of the other companies, like Connecticut General, whatever, was taken on pursuant to different, like, master services agreements, supplemental services agreement, you know, whatever they're called. But each one entered into it at a different time, pursuant to different terms. If there were going to be some mega litigation, let's say, where all these plaintiffs with all these different companies were all together, wouldn't each set of plaintiffs need to look at a different agreement to prove the privity with Lincoln?
So it may be.
Maybe they all win. Maybe they all lose. Maybe some win and some lose. But isn't the point that each of them would have to use different corpus of evidence to climb their own respective hill, even if you think they're all going to get to the top or not?
Well, my point is, I will answer your question, but just continuing on with that metaphor, is that once you get to the top of that hill, then everyone is facing the same sheer wall.
Yeah, I get that. So
to go beyond
what
that.
What do you do about getting up the hill if everyone's going to climb a different hill and it looks a little different? The path of each hill is somewhat different.
So clearly, privity is an issue that is a defense that we would maintain if the case were to go forward. I think the arguments against the privity defense have a common through line, right? And I'm sure that class counsel can talk to you about the ways in which they would try to attack those arguments in the same way. Even if it's a different, for example, agreement, the same argument that it's uniform conduct by Lincoln, that FPP has no employees, that Lanning has 4 employees, that when we litigate these cases in a coordinated fashion in the objectors' cases, it's the same 30B6 witness who provides the testimony on behalf of all 3 different entities. It is the same documents that they use when they find one document that they like involving a particular Lincoln National policy. They trot that out to prove liability and to prove other issues regarding the other issuers.
But that's supposed to go to manageability, right? Isn't the issue, if you're actually litigating this, doesn't that get you to the Mazai Money Store case where the incentives of people who have the direct agreement wouldn't give them the incentive to prove a separate liability that they're not personally
so
to?
So the manageability issues fall out when you have
I
a class
that.
Settlement.
Right.
And in the Mazai case in particular, that if you look at the timing of that case, the class was certified with a privity issue. The trial was held. We won't have a trial in this case. The court found that, notwithstanding what the jury came back with, the court found that there were challenges and insufficient evidence to actually prove privity. And then the court decertified the class after the failure to prove privity on the merits. We are at the point where we are settling this case before that trial takes place.
But if the lesson of that case is, let's pretend you weren't settling it. Okay. Let's pretend you were here seeking to certify the same class for purposes of litigation. And it
well, I personally would not be certified.
Right.
That's not me, but,
yeah. But
and I'm happy to yield the podium to my learned
right.
colleagues.
Let's imagine that, right? The incentive problem would be the same problem that wasn't identified until after the litigation in the Mazai Money Store case, after the trial, but it's still the same difference in incentives.
I believe that class counsel would say that their incentive to prove that Lincoln National's administration harmed them carries through for the rest of their class.
I realize I'm pushing you on something that you push your colleague on.
Okay. As to the argument regarding the $66 million that's on the table and Judge Robinson's point that in any negotiation you're going to make compromises, what's important here is that $66 million figure does not, in our view, it's no longer on the table following Judge Carter's opinion in the second in the Southern District, where he came out with the same interpretation that Judge Shea did, that that based on is not exclusive, and that the mortality component needs to be the main or significant ingredient, and there is no obligation to change unless those terms no longer ring true.
Yeah, so that second part I don't understand. I kept rereading the Vita decision, trying to figure out where it said that the test for evaluating whether the failure to adjust the mortality, you know, adjust the CMI mm-hmm. when the mortality assumptions changed, only kicks in when the mortality assumptions fall below 50% in any given period. And what I understood the test to be is not that there's a dollar for dollar. So I do think that at least in the cases that would be governed by the Vita decision, I don't think the Pennsylvania cases necessarily would, but there's not going to be the dollar for dollar, and that's going to knock some damages out. But what I took to be the holding is defendant would be liable where the decrease in their mortality rate assumptions were so significant that the lack of a corresponding decrease in COI rate determinations would cause the class policy terms to ring hollow. And I didn't see any qualification that you only bring that assessment to bear in circumstances in which the mortality rate component of the COI is less than 50%.
Right. So you're exactly right, Your Honor. The 50% kind of threshold is not present in Judge Carter's opinion. What he says is that it has to be a main or significant ingredient. And that's the provision that would ring hollow. So Judge Shea below said it would be a very difficult time for anyone to argue that the mortality component is not a main or significant ingredient if it takes up half or more of the rest of the rate. So the quantitative analysis—
Was that with reference—I mean, there's sort of the claim that you stuffed the COI with other stuff— sort of from the outside.
The loading
and then issue. There's the sort of adjusting along the way. And do you understand Judge Shea to be saying that you don't even have to sort of fuss with the adjustments along the way as long as you're greater than 50%?
Absolutely. I think both courts come to that conclusion.
Okay.
So both the Glover case has a failure to lower claim as mortality expectations allegedly improve. And that is the primary claim in the Vita case. So if you read, when you read Judge Carter's summary judgment opinion, and he says there is no obligation to change on a monthly or annual basis, there is an obligation to change only when the improvement is so substantial that the class terms ring hollow. So that your point, your question, is raised in their reply brief, suggesting that this 50% metric has no place on a improving mortality slash failure to decrease claim. That is absolutely wrong. Well, so it is the same claim in both of the cases.
I guess I do think you're drawing an inference that I didn't see in the plain language of the words of the opinion, but I take your point.
So if you, I think the steps are the Judge Carter found based on is not exclusive. Then he rejected our argument, Lincoln's argument, that there was no obligation to adjust the rate full stop. He says you do have an obligation to adjust if the change is so significant that the contract language rings hollow. And I think the only way of reading the rings hollow language is if the mortality component is no longer the main or significant ingredient following that improvement.
Okay. Unless there are any further questions right now, I think we have your argument. Thank you, Mr. Sell.
Thank you very much.
While we hear from Mr. Savage, you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal, and we're going to try to keep it tightly to 2 minutes.
Okay? Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll
try to hit 3 points within that 2 minutes. So I want to get to the question that I think Judge Robinson was struggling with earlier, which is the core question that this court is answering here is whether this action is the right platform to release all of these claims. And I think, Judge Robinson, you put it rightly when you said earlier that they're trying to accomplish something indirectly that they couldn't do directly. And that is borne out by looking at the complaint in the Glover action, which, it is true, contains zero allegations as to how the First Penn or New York policies could establish privity with Lincoln National. My colleague on the other side talked about the fact that, well, maybe there might be some other common law theories by which Lincoln National could be held liable. That is exactly what Judge Shea talked about in his preliminary approval order, positing different theories by which Lincoln National could be held responsible on other theories. And then he retracted that those theories in the final approval order. And the only answer on the privity issue was that, oh, it won't actually be an issue at trial. But of course privity, if this action, if the Glover action went to trial, would be an issue. It would be disputed. And frankly, those claims would be dismissed in the Glover action. By contrast, in the First Penn, in the New York cases, those claims proceed directly against the issuers. Privity would not be an issue in those cases. And that is why this is the wrong action to release those claims, because that significant hurdle that could not be proven, was not even alleged in the Glover complaint, would not be an issue in those other cases. And so this is the Glover did not have the appropriate leverage to negotiate a settlement on their behalf. Just briefly on the waiver points, we certainly did not waive the strength of the claims arguments. That's in our opening brief at pages 12 to 14, among other things. And on fairness, we are challenging this under 23A, because that is how this court has looked at questions of structural fairness under cases like literary works. Those have all been considered under 23A. Unless there are further questions, we'd ask the court to reverse.
Very good. Thank you to all counsel. Very helpful arguments, and we will take the case under advisement. So thank you all, and have a good day.